possibly historically, and you've got
but demand it at home, because nothing's going to be granted to you.
But I think, you know, it would be demanded both of the international community who got us into this state in the first place, as well as from the current government. And incidentally, there's a document that was signed on the 23rd of April 1994, in which the ANC agreed that if there had to be sufficient support for the notion of a fourth start, it would be granted to us. And very many people are, I mean, of course, they could always renege on that, but many people don't know about that. But I think for this year, or this coming year in 2010, one of the things I want to do is to publicize this document as widely as possible in South Africa and even internationally, and to persuade people that if enough of us show our support by voting for the Freedom Front in local elections or national elections, then eventually the negotiations around an independent state would have to get off the ground. But of course, it's not to say that the current government will take it seriously, but you know, if you at least start off from some moral basis, you can always push things further.
From what I can see of the current government, there is absolutely nothing reliable or in any way that you... I mean, you were, I think, last month at a conference on minority rights, and which I read about, and I was doing some research on you, Dan, and some individual, some black official, said quite explicitly that he had absolutely no intention of discussing recognition, even, of Afrikaners as a minority. Never mind giving them anything. I mean, it was so explicit, it really did leave very little room, I think, for hope that you'll ever get anywhere from negotiating with these people. And,
We still, you know, contribute a large proportion of the taxes in this country, including local taxes. And, you know, especially in the countryside these days, many of these small towns, people are starting to withhold the local taxes from, you know, the municipalities. It's done in a very careful sort of a way, in, you know, people deposit their money into trust accounts and so on, and they declare legal disputes with the municipalities because they're not delivering any services, or, you know, they're not adhering to legal standards and so on. So there is some sort of a movement like that gaining ground. But ultimately, you know, if we had to start withholding taxes on a large scale, South Africa would be bankrupt within a month or two. Then, you know, there would be some serious negotiations, because, you know, our ruling elite have become used to living the life of, you know, Marie Antoinette or the Sun King Louis XIV. They live absolutely, you know, there's such conspicuous consumption in South Africa nowadays. Every black Mercedes you see on the road has a black driver, and he's got some connection with government or the ANC, or black empowerment, black economic empowerment deals, affirmative action posts, and so on. So ultimately, they would want to cling onto that luxurious lifestyle that they've got now, and I think perhaps that will then become the incentive for them to negotiate with us.
What about the economic danger to that? I mean, one is amazed at the reports of the growth of the South African economy after all these years. I think most people who have got the kind of political views that we have would regard that as being highly unlikely, yet they're still reporting growth. And there is still a great deal of investment coming from overseas into the country. At what point does this become...
South Africa was starved of capital for at least 10 years, you know, prior to 1994.
Right.
So suddenly you had a huge influx of foreign capital, also money, South African money that was held abroad and that was repatriated to the country. So you had a tremendous boom in both the property market and the stock market, capital markets generally. Interest rates went from something like 15 to 16% to 8%.
Right.
And you know, and that's an historic event. And under those conditions, you have to have economic growth. But at the same time, what was really happening was that there was no longer much investment in infrastructure. A lot of the public infrastructure was not being maintained. All of it went into consumption. It went into empowering black people and creating the so-called black middle class. They also used the term, yeah, the black diamonds. There are now something like 2 million black diamonds in South Africa. That's like black middle class consumers who all earn huge salaries, drive fancy cars, shop to the drop, and so on. So all of the money went into that, but there hasn't really been investment in infrastructure, and we used to manufacture a whole variety of goods here. All of that fell by the wayside. You know, our clothing industry, for example, textile and so on, textiles, that simply disappeared. So nowadays, yes, exactly. You know, we've gone back to being basically a resource-based economy where we export precious metals, especially platinum and other raw materials, and we import finished goods from China, mainly. When you've got a huge trade deficit with China, you know, and some German cars and so on, you know, German and French cars. But at the moment, and of course the, you know, the public finances were run fairly conservatively by Trevor Manuel, the previous Minister of Finance. But at the moment, budget deficit is going for a loop. We're running about an 8% budget deficit of 8 to 9% of GDP. You know, our trade deficit is going through the roof. So sooner or later, things will come home to roost. And at the moment, we are experiencing a fairly deep recession, and there's huge unemployment among both black and white people, and especially among whites, because they're feeling it due to the recession and also due to all the racial impediments to being employed and being economically active, you know, all of the stuff to do with affirmative action, so-called employment equity, and so on. So, you know, I don't see South Africa over the next 5 to 10 years doing economically very well. I mean, and part of it was also driven over the last year or two by the expectations around the Soccer World Cup, which will take place in 2010 in South Africa, of course. I mean, they've spent a lot of money on building stadiums, which will become white elephants afterwards, and someone will have to pay for all of that expenditure. So, yeah, I don't see a brilliant economic future for us in the next 5 to 10 years, unless there's some political change.
Well, you know, I've seen one or two white South African blogs, which are populated by people who have got tremendous optimism. And I've heard the word the vibe quite regularly used amongst optimists. I imagine most of these people are English speakers, and I imagine they're products of, you know, the ineffable lightness of being, which is the gift of modernity. I'm amazed that this sort of feeling of optimism still persists, despite all the obvious signs of collapse that you see everywhere. But they manage to excuse it. They manage to say that, oh, well, you know, the life here is so good, the beach life and the beautiful climate and open-air life, and I love all of that, and I've been in Europe, and I've come back because this is the great life sort of thing. So there's this capacity for people to maintain optimism that, in a way, is not much less frightening than the capacity, which I think probably reflects the Boers, to endure bad times. And they're both productive of stability. They're not producers in themselves of the kind of change that might actually give life to whites, which is what's actually needed. So, in the end, the question comes down to how many people understand that this is a matter of life and death they're talking about. Not necessarily at the individual level, I'm sure they already got a grasp of that, but at the collective level. Now, looking at the way I know my own people behave here, I doubt very much whether the good climate lovers in Cape Town, who are English speakers, would move very quickly towards a understanding that they've got to do something to secure their own existence.
Well, you know, when you're talking about Cape Town, that's completely different because historically, you know, the Cape has only really been fought, I mean, South Africa as an entity has really only existed since 1910. And Cape Town is geographically so far removed from the rest of South Africa, separated by the Karoo, which is a semi-desert. And of course, there are far fewer blacks in Cape Town than in any other part of the country except the Northern Cape. So, you know, it's possible to have the kind of illusion of living in an almost a European country when you're down in Cape Town. And, you know, what's happening in the rest of the country is just so remote that for people not particularly interested in politics or economics and studying things in the finer detail, I suppose you can enjoy the beach life and the weather and so on down in Cape Town. It's a particular subculture, it's geographically isolated, but no one up here in the north of the country is really under any illusions. And if you talk to people, you know, I know a lot of academics and, you know, people who used to be very liberal to left-wing, and they've all become extremely disillusioned about the current situation. And I've also seen in the Afrikaans press, even in the mainstream press, you know, the papers put out by Naspers, I've seen a big change over the last 6 months where they're now, you know, allowing people to express their frustrations and dissatisfaction. And this journalist that I spoke about earlier on who committed suicide.
Yes, this is Chris Lowe, isn't it?
Chris Lowe, yes. Yeah. Very complex man, but also very talented, and he had particular insights as to where we were going. And he's written just recently quite a few articles where he went in some of the mass circulation dailies and Sunday papers, where he went quite far in spelling out that, you know, we were sort of hurtling headlong into disaster. So I think the message is out there now that unless we do something fairly radical quite soon, we have no real future in this country anymore. I mean, things are just going to deteriorate to a level where it will become completely unlivable.
Do you place any credence in the Mandela death pogrom? Well,
you know, I've actually seen that video. There was a CD, DVD video going around at one point where people, you know, one person was making an argument like that. And I don't think there's a particular, master plan or a plot to exterminate whites the day Mandela dies. But on the other hand, you know, to anyone who's lived in this country for a long time, you know that there's a particular group dynamic amongst Africans that takes over during times of, you know, social crisis or the death of a headman. For example, in traditional culture, if lightning had to kill one member of a tribe, the whole tribe had to demolish all of their dwellings and move to another place. And during that process, there are all sorts of rituals taking place, including in some tribes, mass orgies, slaughtering of animals, and so on. So an event like that, where someone like Mandela has had so much publicity and he's so much revered, it has the potential for sparking off some sort of mass action, including violence and possibly even attacks on minority groups. I wouldn't exclude that, even though I don't say that there is some sort of a plot.
There is, in fact, a veiled threat in a single comment. I think it's on your English language side. I don't know whether you've actually noticed that, but you might want to have a look for it and remove it sometime. Because it wouldn't add to the quality of the site in any way, shape or form. But it was certainly there a few days ago when I was looking through.
Oh, I see.
On one of the more recent posts, yeah. Okay. The military performance over the farm murders, I mean, absolutely incredible performance over the farm murders by the ANC politicians. Do you think that holds any clues as to the kind of response that would be forthcoming if there was a, not perhaps programmatic, but a general violence post-Mandela directed to white South Africans? I mean, the government, especially under Zuma, I would suggest, isn't going to be better at dealing with that than Mbeki's government was at dealing with the Boer genocide.
Yes. Well, I perfectly agree with you there. You know, the police force in this country, I mean, Chris Lowe, in his very last column that he wrote before he killed himself, he spoke of the criminal inability or unwillingness of the police to do anything about attacks on farmers. And, you know, our police is just completely useless, so they wouldn't be able to protect anyone, barring a few fairly well-trained, motivated white Afrikaners still left in the police force. But, you know, in terms of numbers, they wouldn't be able to influence things very much. So, you know, the flip side of the coin is that there wouldn't be a planned genocide in South Africa simply because the government doesn't have the capacity to organize something like that. There could be spontaneous mass violence and crowds and so on, but it wouldn't be a planned thing because the government isn't capable of something like that, just like it isn't capable of protecting us. Increasingly, and that for me is very encouraging, you find almost sort of suburban militia forming in some of the areas where people start patrolling their own neighborhoods and they start training themselves and arming themselves.
Is there a move afoot to disarm the white population, though?
Yes, definitely. You know, the ANC have made a new gun rule, which was so ridiculous that eventually it got challenged in the courts. And fortunately, the Hunters Association, representing about 50,000 hunters, they managed to get a reprieve for gun owners. But the whole thing is still making its way through the courts. But at one point, you know, thousands of people were handing in their guns because it was going to get so difficult, legally speaking and in terms of the regulations, to justify owning a gun. But, you know, we encourage people not to hand in their guns and to simply keep them, because ultimately the government can't arrest hundreds of thousands of people simply because they, you know, exercise their right to be owners. And, you know, there's sort of another key cliche or an older dodge. A white man without a gun in Africa is a dead man. And, you know, if you look at our history, including that famous incident in the 19th century when Peter Thief and his men left their guns outside Dingaan's kraal and they all got, you know, 80 of them got massacred. You know, not, I think the only thing that's really kept us going in this country is the knowledge that everyone has that there must be about 2 or 3 million guns still owned.
That and the fact that Boers were killing British soldiers at a range of 1,700 yards in the Second War, I think it was. A famous world record shot, wasn't it?
I mean, there's a tremendous hunting and gun culture in this country among Afrikaners, and you know, most people, even from a very early age, some or other time will handle a weapon. And even years until very recently at the high schools, all the boys used to practice marksmanship as a sport with .22 rifles and so on. And I think that's one reason why this government hasn't quite treated us like Mugabe has treated whites in Rhodesia, because they do, I mean, open hostilities would eventually, you know, not be in their interest, I would say.
The last thing I'd like you to talk is not unrelated to the gun, because I'm talking here about this unique and quite rich Afrikaner character, and that's the power of the soil and of the landscape to inform the culture and personality. And, you know, there's this image of the conservative Afrikaner who has great love and loyalty and connectedness to the soil. And I know you, at some point in the past, have written about the landscape of Karoo, I think, which is quite important to the sense of Afrikaner identity. And I wonder whether you could impart something of that.
Yes. Well, you know, South Africa is really almost, compared to Europe and its rainfall, it's almost a desert. You know, only about 6% of this country is really arable. So we've got used to farming and making a living in a country where it doesn't rain most of the time, and, you know, where people have gone through tremendous hardship over many years, and they've had to endure all sorts of calamities. And that has really hardened us and made us, to some extent, stoic and able to take probably more punishment than most people. And that might be one other reason why there hasn't been a spontaneous revolt in South Africa, even though we've been killed and attacked.
The capacity for endurance,
Yeah, exactly. So when you speak about culture, you know, we've got a very strong culture and sense of identity, probably much stronger than that of the Australians or even some of the smaller European nations that have not been independent all that long. And might have been dominated by bigger nations throughout most of their history. So I think in the end, that might pull us through, and it might enable us to survive and overcome our present circumstances that are quite dire, especially if looked at from the outside.
Well, okay. Dan, I'm very grateful to you. I know it's quite late where you are. I want to thank you very much for your patience. And I hope that it's been a useful experience for everybody who's listened. That was Dr. Dan Root. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.